WEBR Fairfax Radio. You're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew, and joining me today on the Commons is one of my favorite guests of all times, Professor Evan McKenzie. Evan, thank you. I know it's cold in Chicago, and you came in, and I hope you're nice and cozy, because I'm ready to have a nice long chat with you today.
That's great, Shu. It's nice to be with you again.
Evan, you are the author of Privatopia. You also have a blog called Privatopia, and you've been sort of commenting on a lot of not just the HOA issues anymore, but also the financial crisis across the country, well, globally, really. How does all that affect homeowners associations?
I've been concerned for a long time, as you probably know. I've been writing and talking about this for a long time, about the financial viability of this whole form of residential private government. I've been talking about it now for many, many years. And I've always thought that one possibility was that individual associations could become insolvent for a variety of reasons, or you could have a whole sector-wide problem with insolvency of associations, just as has happened with the savings and loan industry, which was the example I always used to use.
Mm-hmm.
And now I can just talk about Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and, you know, the major banks in the country, you know. It's certainly possible that huge numbers of associations could fail, and that this entire form of housing could be in serious jeopardy. And when the whole housing debacle started and prices started collapsing, in fact, even before that, I was talking about the bubble, what was going to happen when the bubble collapsed. I've been very concerned about what's going to happen to associations and all the people living in them, because I think many, many people, in fact, I'd say probably 90-95% of the people who live in associations do not understand the nature of their personal financial stake in the association itself and the degree to which they can end up paying the debts of the association. And so when all this these institutional collapses started, I began to think, you know, what we have here is a sort of, I've referred to this type of housing as trickle-down privatization, but what we're seeing now is the sort of trickle-down bailout demands, you know, starting from the very top of the economy and going down, 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 down. It's like every level of government, every type of corporation now wants money from the federal government, and it's just, there isn't enough. There isn't enough, not even close to being enough. And homeowner associations are very likely to end up, some of them at least, are likely to end up standing in the bailout line.
You think so?
I think it's entirely possible. I think that Julio Rubina raised that possibility in Florida a few weeks ago of condominium associations. I mean, look at it this way. If we accept the argument that associations are doing things, many of which would otherwise be done by local government, and if the local governments are already in the bailout line, which is true, they are, you know, state, counties, and cities are demanding money. Detroit is, and several other cities have asked for money, bailout money. There's a huge county in Alabama, Jefferson County, that is on the verge of a multi-billion-dollar bankruptcy, the biggest municipal bankruptcy in history if they vote to do it. States like California and other states saying, I mean, associations are doing the work that local governments have historically done. And if that is the case, and if they can't carry out their functions, everybody else is getting in line, why would you not expect, you know, the associations to start getting in the what Fred Pilot calls the bailout bread line anyway, themselves?
Well, that's going to put paid to the thing that associations protect property values, because obviously that's been one of the lies all along, to get people to move into associations.
Uh-huh.
It's really hard to say now that associations protect your values, because they don't.
Yeah.
It's
well,
clear.
if you look at as it stands right now, the greatest loss in property values has happened in the states that have the highest percentage of common interest housing. Now, that's partly because that's where the bubble was the worst. That is, they were artificially inflated. But California, Nevada, Florida, and a couple of other states are the hardest hit in terms of loss of property value. And that's where the highest share of common interest housing has been. It's in the very states where you find the two things. One, the highest percentage of common interest housing. Two, the greatest loss of property values.
Am I putting words in your mouth when I say that the association concept is a failed concept, experiment, if you will?
No, I'm not ready to say that. I don't know. It has some huge structural problems. That's what I've always said. that it has there's some big structural problems with the way this type of local government, and that's really what it is being set up. This has been a gigantic experiment. It's lasted a little over 30 years. I mean, I'm distinguishing between the days when these were really voluntary and what we see today. You know, pre-1970s, you could actually say this was voluntary, because if you wanted to live in this type of housing, you had to go out and find it. And there wasn't much of it. But what has happened is there's been a structural transformation in local governance, and it's become virtually, you know, all you can find in many parts of the country, because local governments and developers are so dependent on it. And they've been imposing it on consumers. And if you look at that era is only at most 40 years old. I'd say it's more like 30 to 35 years old.
Yeah.
And that experiment that is making this the way local governance is going to be accomplished, these weird sort of private-public arrangements that are not well-structured, not well-thought-out, and different everywhere, this has a lot of problems. And I don't see this being addressed by any state. I see lots of talk about process regulations, about, you know, making rules about, making laws about how meetings should be conducted and elections should be run,
yeah,
and all this. There's tons of that stuff, and of course it is necessary. I agree. But the underlying problem, local state legislatures are not even interested in talking about it.
That's because it's counter to what's good for them. I mean, they want to keep the associations up and running because it gives them a free ride on the taxes.
Certainly.
And so they're not about to pull the plug on that. In fact, they're making it even, if you look at Fairfax County, and I don't know how representative Fairfax County is of the rest of the country, but what they're trying to do over here is take down all the developments that were built prior to the HOA mandates, saying that they're not viable, use of land. It's not smart use of land anymore. And they're replacing it with all of this new urbanist construction, which absolutely has to have an association in place.
Yeah.
I mean, that's part of the whole concept of new urbanism, is to turn it over to a homeowners association. So we obviously haven't learned a lesson. Is this going to be a wake-up call, do you think? The financial disaster now? are we going to get smart, Evan?
No, I don't. No, I don't, actually. I don't think that there's going to be I don't think it's going to be a wake-up call. I really don't. In fact, I think that it's very likely that the Obama administration and the people he puts in charge of HUD and FHA and so forth are going to be more wedded to common interest housing than any previous administration in history.
That's sad.
Because they are... Look, let's face it. I mean, Obama said when he was at Harvard Law School that the suburbs bore him, that the whole idea of suburbanization and suburbs and suburbanites, he finds it boring. He is just the quintessential urban Democrat right out of the Chicago machine. They what they're going to do, I think, is promote sort of like what Anthony Villaraigosa has promoted in Los Angeles, what urban Democrats promote everywhere, which is high concentration, mm-hmm, high density land use.
That's smart.
And they're going to, that's so-called smart growth. That's what they're going to want to do. They don't like suburbanization because they think suburbanization means sprawl.
Yes. That's a dirty word.
That's a dirty word. They don't like that. So they want to do is get us all living in condominiums and apartment buildings. And that's their idea of how to use land. That's what they're going to promote. That's what they're going to encourage.
Well, that's
going to require associations.
And that's what they're doing here. And part of the idea for new urbanism is having it run by a homeowners association.
Absolutely.
And so you're kind of stuck. So it doesn't sound like we've learned much, huh?
No. And if you look at the way this whole Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac credit default swap debacle began to unfold, you can see that there was not a trace of foresight at any level of government. There were people talking about this, and I've been writing about this on my weblog, but the reason is because this is really closely related to what's going on with common interest housing. It's a very important situation. The parallels and the connections are very powerful, I think. These people, including the president, just sat there and basically did little or nothing while all these financial markets melted down. And when people a few years ago tried to rein in Fannie Mae because no one could even figure out how much money they had or what their financial exposure was, and it's all ultimately insured in some sense by the taxpayers. Maybe not literally, but in reality, debts, the government was standing behind them, and everybody knew it.
Yeah.
And this was unfolding, and people were pointing out that this situation is such that we don't know how much money they have, and we don't know what their risk is, and Congress didn't pass anything to fix it. And then the president stood and watched this stuff. I know that people were involved and have been involved for probably 8 months in trying to prevent the financial markets from collapsing, because I actually know people who were involved in it. They've been flying all over the world, flying back and forth to Europe and everything else to try to prevent what happened. And the president didn't say anything about it until the beginning of October. Didn't even prepare the public for it. Congress wasn't doing anything. Nobody was doing anything in government about it. They just simply let it happen. And that's what I see going on here. I think the bottom line here is that if you're an owner in one of these associations, you as an individual, you are exposed to potentially tremendous losses, including the value of whatever equity you have. I mean, it's limited only by the equity that you have in your home. And most owners simply don't understand that, but that is what is at stake here, is that people are going to be foreclosed on by their association or by a receiver representing a judgment creditor of the association, because you're ultimately going to have to pay the debts of the association, and the association cannot get completely out from under those debts by even filing bankruptcy. Even if they file for bankruptcy, the owners are still going to be liable. And, you know, people don't understand this, but it's been, this process has been gone through by creditors in Los Angeles. It's a bankruptcy court published opinion, and that's the way it's going to work. And there's a process in place for executing on it. And so, you know, if these associations become insolvent because they have all these owners who have already been foreclosed on by their banks, who've walked away from the mortgages, the banks aren't paying the assessments like they're supposed to. Money is just hard to get. They can't borrow money because they have too many renters, so they can't get loans, and on and on. And these associations get in serious financial trouble. They can't pay their bills, can't do repairs. Look, the owners are standing at the bottom of the ladder, so to speak. And they're going to get hit with whatever falls down, and that's the way this thing is set up. This type of housing has always depended almost entirely, ultimately, on the resources of the individual owners. I mean, it depends on their time, their energy, their effort, their honesty, their wisdom, their judgment, their commitment, their loyalty, and their money. That's what it relies on, and that is the key problem with common interest housing.
And
you know,
that's not something that owners have ever been told. They've been told that it protects property values. They've been told that they will be living the life of Riley.
Right.
Because now all of a sudden they'll have access to a pool for free.
Right.
And tennis courts and riding trails and all of that other wonderful stuff. But nobody, the disclosure that you just gave us is not in the least bit something that homeowners have ever been told.
That's right. They are told everything that is necessary to sell them the units.
They're lied to.
And nothing that is necessary in order to operate the association, and nothing that would discourage them. And, you know, no one says, oh, by the way, do you know that national, state, and local government are going to do absolutely nothing to support the efforts of these volunteer directors? That there are no qualifications for being a volunteer director, that in most states you don't even need a license to be a property manager, and many of these people, even if they're licensed, have no education, training, experience, and many of the property managers have no idea what they're doing. I mean, nobody tells them these things, and you know, if you go into these things with your eyes open, there's nothing wrong with it. But when you have, you know, hundreds of owners are roped into these things, they don't even understand the rules of the game, it's pretty scary.
What does licensing really do for you? I mean, other than give the state a few bucks and create another another agency to track down who has a license and all that. I mean, CAI is going to end up doing the training. And in order to have the training, you're going to have to become a member of CAI. I mean, that's the way the new laws in Virginia are set up. I mean, the only benefit is going to be to increase the membership for CAI.
Yeah, if that's the way it goes, if what we end up with is basically a certification by CAI.
That's it.
Instead of a professional licensing by something like a state bar association for lawyers, if we're going to end up with, a fully private organization that, of course, bar associations can be very self-interested too, but if CAI is going to do all the training, they know how to train professionals. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. They know what community managers are supposed to do better than anybody. That's not the problem. I think the problem is really that there's got to be some accountability to public standards, not just to private standards. And, you know, what we have now is there's no, little or no public support, public institutional support, and little or no public oversight to see that they live up to public standards of accountability. And that's what needs to take place. And we do that for the most part with attorneys, we do it with physicians, we do it with accountants, you know, but we aren't doing it with community managers and certainly not with the attorneys who represent these associations.
We're talking to Professor Evan McKenzie. Evan is the author of Privatopia and also has a blog. You want to give us the blog address, Evan?
Sure.
Because you do a great job of updating it all the time.
Thank you. It's called the Privatopia Papers, and it is at it's on Blogspot. So it's privatopia.blogspot.com.
And although you've got a lot of non-HOA links and articles there now, but they're all tied into the big picture.
That's the way I see it. Some people say I've been talking too much about politics or too much about the bailout and everything, but the fact is these things are all related. They're all related to what's going on with common interest housing one way or another. And, the connections are clear enough to me, and, you know, I don't want to just be boring, but so I try to liven it up. There's also a lot of humor there.
I do appreciate the humor, although the serious stuff, there's nothing to laugh about there. It's a little bit scary, and you haven't exactly been painting a very rosy picture about homeowner associations and the future of homeowner associations. In fact, the present of homeowner associations either.
Well, the problem, you know, it's funny. I don't like to be this sort of Cassandra-type person who's predicting doom and gloom. But, and it doesn't have to be. I feel like I'm sitting in the back seat of a car and there's a turn coming up and someone's driving straight ahead and not hitting the brakes.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't, you don't have to have an accident. Nothing bad has to happen. But if you don't turn, it will.
Yeah.
And that's what I see going on here. I'm not a huge George Soros fan, but I know he has a lot of questionable policies and practices, but he wrote a book that came out, I believe, in March of this year, in which he predicted exactly what happened to the financial markets 8 months, 7 or 8 months later. He predicted it exactly, and the book had to go to press long before that. Probably a year ago, this book went to press. And he predicts the failure of the credit default swap market and says it's going to dwarf everything that happened before. Now, Shu, I mean, when people are predicting these things, and they happen anyway, you know, really, this strikes me as being totally unnecessary. And when I say some of these things, I mean, it doesn't mean that he wanted those bad things to happen. He was trying to prevent them. And when I say that owners are susceptible to paying these gigantic judgments, look, I'm not making this up.
No.
This has already happened.
Yeah, no, I know. And
it's going to happen a lot more. It's going to continue to happen, particularly since a lot of these properties are starting to wear out, which is so predictable. These roofs that were built 30 years ago have a 30-year lifespan. It's really about that simple, you know?
And now you need the money.
And now you need the money. Yeah.
I heard from someone who said that they're imposing, without any real authority to do so, but they're imposing these huge fees on people who buy into an association, into their particular association. They want $2,000, $3,000, $4,000, which are capitalization fees. because you didn't contribute to the roof while it was good to fund the capitalization to replace the roof. So now that you're buying into it, you've got to pay your fair share going back to however many years ago it was. The fact that the owner has been paying into it or should have been paying into it has nothing to do with it. I mean, associations have got this really convoluted way of looking at the real world, I think.
Well, that's going to be really, see, that the doing things like that, that all would have to be disclosed before the purchase. Otherwise, you're going to end up with a lawsuit over that.
It is being disclosed, which is why nothing is moving.
Right, so then no one's going to buy. And why should I buy? You know, that means you've imposed a special assessment. You're never going to be able to sell a unit.
And the property values plunge, and the homeowners get frustrated, and the association forecloses and turns it over to a developer. I mean, I'm starting to hear a whole lot of scenarios that are exactly like that, Evan.
Well, this is very bad because all this leads to, if foreclosure and this sort of thing leads to a whole host of other problems, including large numbers of renters. And if you get large numbers of renters, then pretty soon at some point the association can't borrow money. I mean, credit has already tightened up, obviously, for all these external reasons. But, if Fannie Mae, according to what I read, is now tightening up the requirements on associations. So they don't want to, because they're going down the tubes, they don't want to lend money to people to buy risky common interest housing units. So if there's a higher than a certain percentage of units rented, they won't insure the mortgage.
But the whole purpose of this is to, they don't want to sell it. They want to devalue it to the point that a developer can pick it up for nothing. Julio Rabina, Representative Julio Rabina from Florida, was on, oh gosh, last year, and he was talking about high-rise condos doing that, or sort of mid-sized condos doing that, because now a developer can come in and doesn't want to pay the owners full market value so that he can tear down the building and rebuild it. So what they're doing is they're working with the board members to just run the homeowners down, and they're foreclosing, and then, you know, the developers acquiring all of these properties and tearing them down and building these huge luxurious properties, but they don't want to put out the money ahead of time. I don't know how that's working out right now in terms of the financial meltdown properties, but that was going on for a number of years.
Well, that would be make matters even worse. But I, as you say, in the current development climate, I wonder how much of that's going to go on, because
I just heard about one two days ago, and this is where you've got lots. So they're buying they're acquiring the lots for nothing. They're running the values down, acquiring the lots for nothing. They'll sit on it because, you know, we all know that real estate is cyclical. We had an adjustment 20 years ago. 18 years ago, where we went through the same thing and we didn't learn our lesson then.
Yeah, that's, I think there was a big problem in 90s and 92, I guess.
Yeah, where people were paying hundreds of thousands of dollars more than the property was worth. And then at some point, you know, the bubble burst. And everybody blamed the appraisers because they were appraising the property for the sales price. And the banks were left holding the baby, and people were, you know, short-staffed. They were upside down at the times. And we sort of went back up and rebuilt it, and we did the same thing again.
Well, yeah,
I've seen that. This is the third time I've seen this happen since I've been in this country.
Well, I don't know what's going to, you know, the really scary part about this is at this point, it's hard to see what is going to restart the market. And I'm really not clear on it, and I don't think anybody is. I'm sure somebody will come up with something, but there's a whole psychology, bull market psychology of an expectation that prices will go up. And right now you're saying, and I think this is probably true, that prices are so low that the people buying in are these speculators and developers who are going to wait it out, hold the property and wait. But in terms of the public, at some point, the only way prices are going to go up is if the public starts to believe that real estate prices are going to go back up.
In some associations, some of them are larger ones where you've got a lot of it has not been developed, where the developer sold lots and people bought lots to build down the road, you know, when they were ready to build. So they bought the lots as investments years ago, and they've been sitting on it. Desert Carmel is one such. There's like 3,500 lots there, and with only 200 houses that have been built on. And that was a case where the developer, or it was taken over, the board was taken over, and they're running the prices, the values way down so that the developer can acquire all of these. The developer owns, a new developer has come in and owns a substantial block of lots, like 1,300. So they've got all the votes and they're not paying the assessments. And, you know, you can imagine the whole scenario. I heard of exactly the same thing happening here in an association in Virginia called Lake Holiday, and we're going to be following up on that. But the thing is, you've got a developer in there with a development controlled board, a lot of unbuilt lots, and so they're running the values down and acquiring the lots that way. Whether they build on it this year or in 5 years, at least they will have the land. The one thing we're not making more of is land.
Right.
And so that's what they're doing, is they're getting the land.
No, I see your point. I don't know how prevalent these practices are. I've heard about them, but I don't know how I mean, this is, in essence, developer control of the boards is the, or outside control of the boards is what was, contractor control of the boards is what is at the root of this scandal in Las Vegas. You know, people finding ways to take control of the boards. And this goes back to what I think I keep saying is the Achilles heel of this entire institution. You've got trillions of dollars in home equity and people's lives and personal fortunes and everything else resting on this sort of upside down pyramid, you know. I mean, it's like balancing a pyramid on the point, because the whole thing ultimately rests on the ability of the individual owners to do these very, very complex tasks just exactly right. And it is really, really scary because, you know, you see examples of developers and contractors, may arguably, if all this proves to be true, taking control of the boards. And then they can just, you know, then potentially you could plunder an association, and that means all these people are stuck there. And the scary thing about it is that as an owner, once you get into one of these situations and there's a fiscal problem and a meltdown, you're already on the hook.
Yeah, I mean,
once it happens, it's like you're a fish that's been caught. You've already got the hook in your mouth. You can't get off. That's your first warning, you know. Your first warning is you're stuck. it's really scary. I mean,
well, I think we saw this a long time ago. I think in Wayne Hyatt's article, Evolution and Reinvention, and I'm going back, what, about 10, 12 years ago?
Yeah, that was the John Marshall
Law Review
Symposium. Yeah, he and I were on that together. He gave a talk and wrote an article, and I wrote one in the same issue.
Yeah, he was talking about trying to find alternate ways of funding associations, because he said if the meltdown comes, and I think he must have, I think you both foresaw it, but he was the one who proposed transfer fees. He was the one who proposed capitalization fees just to keep the associations financially healthy. I think Tyler Birding in California is talking about coming up with new creative methods where actually Wayne Hyatt talked about this as well, where you kind of, when you sell your house, that you share the profits that you made with the association, because the association enhanced your property values, which really, you know, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And especially,
why not just set up a limited equity housing cooperative?
That's right. And he was going to cap affordable housing. So, you know, and now we're beginning to see, you know, the mess. I mean, that's just part of it. This is so, so much bigger. But I think he must have, and you both must have foreseen this coming. I know you've been talking mm-hmm. about it, but I don't think you were trying to get more money from the homeowners to keep
no.
the thing solved. But he
no,
was.
I wasn't.
He was.
Yeah.
And if you go back and read his article, he was looking for ways to just keep this ball lead balloon up in the air, basically.
Well, you know, the fact is that if the owners, if people actually understood the full array of costs and benefits at the time of purchase, I think a whole lot of people would say no thank you. But you know, they don't understand at the time of purchase. And then, of course, the law just conclusively presumes that they did understand. And after once you've made that decision, you're stuck. You know, you can't later say, well, I didn't know. Wait a minute, I didn't know I had to, that everything depended on the owners and that the owners could change the rules and that the developer mm-hmm. could take the place. I didn't know that.
Because all the disclosures that we're required to give legally have to do with, you know, there are rules. You cannot hang your linens, you know, your dirty laundry outside on a clothesline. You've got to use a dryer. You've got to have your hose approved. So, I mean, people go along with that. It's kind of stupid, but people, for whatever reason, people will accept that. But nobody says, look, here is the financial reality of what you're doing. Places like Fairfax County, over 90% of all housing is in an association. Since 1984,
yeah.
I think it is, everything that was built is 100% of what was built was in an association.
Sure, and that's true many, many places.
Yeah.
You know, it used to be there were, you could find 10 or 12 locations around the country where it was like that. No, it's basically like that everywhere. Now, I mean, almost not everywhere, but as I keep telling people, even in places like where I live up in remote northern Lake County, Illinois, almost on the Wisconsin border, you can't buy a new house that isn't in an association. You haven't been able to do that for years and years.
Right.
And so, you know, it's going on all over the country, and now, you know, people walk into this and they buy the house, and they're in for the whole lot. I mean, they're in for every aspect of the responsibilities that the law imposes on them. And, you know, it's if they understood, it would be different.
That's because they've been terrified of pink doors and cars on blocks, and that's all they think about. That's all they've been told over and over and over again. They'll protect your property values. If you don't have an association, the guy across the street's going to paint his house green. Or his, you know, he's going to do something atrocious to his house and your property values will plunge. And people buy into that.
I think a lot of people do buy into that. That's one selling point, no doubt about it. I also think that people buy houses without thinking about all these institutional issues. Like you said at
yeah.
the beginning, you know, they don't even often know. And I talk to people about this sort of thing all the time, and I hear all the time from people that they say that they didn't even know there was an association when they bought the house. They didn't even know it existed. These are, you know, intelligent people.
Yeah.
They just didn't even know. When I was house hunting the last time back in 2003, I made a point of asking the realtor. We'd go to this house, and that house, I'd say, is there an association here? And the realtor would say, I don't know, let me check and get back to you. And of course, I could always tell, but,
yeah.
you know, the realtor never knew. They never knew.
Yeah.
Or they would say they didn't know, and they would get, and they treated it like a minor matter. It was something they would never get back to you on this. They just, they're interested in things like, you know, how big the lot is, the, mm-hmm. how old the water heater is, when was the roof replaced, all this stuff, but, you know, the owners walk in and they take on all sorts of financial obligations, and you just have to hope. I hope, you know, that we don't have a huge meltdown. But as this housing ages, especially these big condo buildings and the HOAs that have private streets or anything involving water,
yeah.
these are potentially
yeah.
huge
yeah.
expenditures.
Yeah, they are. They are enormous.
And they think, you know, the first thing they think of when the streets go bad, which is usually pretty quickly, they say, well, let's see if the village or the city will accept dedication of these streets. They do this all the time, you know. And of course, in almost every case, the municipality says no, because they aren't built to public standards. They're not thick enough.
Right.
That's why they wore out so fast, and we don't want them because we can't afford to pay for it either.
Right.
And so you're right back to the owners. They're stuck with it.
Yeah.
And the insurance company isn't going to pay. It's all on the owners.
It's all on the owners. And the thing is, Evan, the thing that really infuriates me is that we're doing this to the entry-level people, the people who are relying on Habitat for Humanity housing. Habitat for Humanity is building associations with substandard roads and substandard everything, putting these people in for next to nothing because everybody has to be a homeowner, and leaving them with running an association and then finding the money to repair things like streets.
Mm-hmm. And, of course, that's right. And who is heavily involved and has been heavily involved throughout his career with low-income housing providers, with the people who are in, with Habitat for Humanity, with Fannie Mae, and on and on? And the answer is our incoming president, which is one of the reasons I've written so much about the election, because Barack Obama has been involved one way or another with all sorts of these low-income housing initiatives. Here in Chicago, I mean directly or indirectly, but here in Chicago, we had this Hope 6 approach where the Clinton administration was promoting condominium ownership for low-income housing people. They redeveloped Cabrini Green and a bunch of other housing projects at enormous public expense. And by the way, it's a vast improvement. I'm not saying it was a bad thing to do, but what they decided to do was leave large numbers of low-income and moderate-income people and put everybody in basically condominium or townhome associations.
Mm-hmm.
And once again, you know, many of them never had the resources to do what was necessary in the first place, either to run the association or to fund it. And so there just have been all kinds of problems with these. And, you know, it's better. I think it's an improvement over what was there before. But once again, when government persist in making this assumption that you can rest all these obligations on the shoulders of owners, especially low-income owners, I mean, it's just ripe for failure because they're imposing too much on individuals. You know, it comes out of this whole Reagan era of privatization, and it's been taken over by the Democrats as well, and they're reinventing government, and they're putting it all on the burden on the shoulders of people who can't carry it. It's too much. It's simply too much. And that's the key structural problem. And unless that problem is addressed, that there's too much reliance placed on the owners to run their associations, to fund their associations, too much reliance, and that there has to be some kind of institutional support that doesn't come from CAI. And I'm not saying that they can't provide any, but they can't provide all of it. Unless that happens, then this is only the beginning. There's going to be a meltdown, I think, in this whole association sector if something isn't done.
We're talking to Professor Evan McKenzie. Evan, we've been talking about the problems. You say unless something is done, what do you see realistically that can be done, and what can the homeowners do? We've had, in the past, you've mentioned getting a homeowner, an organization up and running about homeowners, and I've had a number of people contact me and want you to expand on that. But I'm not sure that that's really going to be effective in the current situation. I don't know that the homeowners are going to be able to take back, you know, the authority to paint their house whatever color they want, or, you know, not have someone mm-hmm. weigh their dogs. I mean, that just seems like uh-huh. such small potatoes now compared to what else we're facing.
Right.
Is there anything that we as homeowners can do, do you think? How can we as Americans counter this?
Well, okay, the only way changes are going to happen is if the policy process produces them. It has to come through politics. It's not just going to come because of newspaper articles or fat dog stories. It's not the people, the owners have to organize themselves somehow, and they have to form alliances with bigger organizations like AARP and so forth. They have to make alliances with consumer organizations and they have to create a network, what sometimes we call it a policy network. They have to create a homeowner-oriented policy network comprised of their own organizations and the alliances they form in order to present a united front. And that would be the first step that would have to happen, because until then, people like me and a few other, and you and others, are just kind of, you know, individual voices pointing these things out. American politics works through groups, and that's the only way it ever works. It does not work through individuals. It works through groups. I mean, even George Soros, with all his money, set up groups, and that's what has to happen. But unfortunately, you know, the first obstacle is that every owner advocate wants their own group. So I don't know how you get past that. You know, they need a national organization. They really do. And they are incapable of just starting one.
There's an organization called Freedom 21, and that takes about 8 or 10 different organizations with different focuses and pulls them all under one umbrella. One of them is concerned about education. Another one's concerned about, land. Another one's concerned about, a number of different issues. But they all sort of have the same ultimate goal. And they kind of, come under this one big umbrella, and they have an annual conference, and they all get together, and they all report on what each group has done. I know that these individual groups are very, very important to the individuals, and some of them have done an outstanding job of mm-hmm. building these groups up. Some of them are getting groups up and running, and they all have their own autonomy. Is there some way that we can leave them autonomous but still bring them under a group and be as effective under an umbrella?
I don't see why not. I don't see why not. A social movement can be organized many different ways. Interest groups, there's a difference between an interest group and a social movement. I mean, some interest groups are organized like the National Rifle Association or CAI. They have two levels, really. They have local chapters and they have a national organization. And there isn't always perfect coordination between them, but there's a lot of communication, and they're basically on the same page. They know that ultimately the Illinois State Rifle Association is affiliated with the NRA, and whatever NRA sends them, they'll send out to their members and that sort of thing. The same with CAI. And that's a typical interest group organization. That's a national interest group. There's lots and lots and lots of them like that. But, you know, and in this case, the national organization came first, and then authorizes all these local chapters that use the same name and the affiliation.
Right.
Now, what we're talking about here is a true grassroots organization. It's more like a social movement, many social movements have been very successful, others have failed, where you have a whole lot of different groups with different orientations, and then something happens to catalyze them and cause them to see themselves as, despite all their differences, as part of one larger movement. And then you can sometimes get a lot of press, achieve some successes, get them to have demonstrations, use unconventional tactics, and many other things that attract attention to their cause. And there what you're trying to do is reach out from a core of dedicated supporters. This is the way social movements are structured. There's always at the core a small number of people who are totally dedicated to it. And every social movement, whether it's abolition of slavery or prohibition or the civil rights movement, they started with this core of dedicated people. And then they move out from that to people who will give you time and energy in substantial quantities but still keep their day job, so to speak. And then outside that is another ring, and that's the interested public that you can really hopefully win to your side. I mean, you can build a movement that way. You definitely can. The core activists can stay in touch with each other and keep trying to reach out to the people. It's like there's an old saying in politics about ham and egg breakfast. Have you ever heard this one?
No, I haven't.
Well, they say there's a difference between being involved and being committed. They say in a ham and egg breakfast, the chicken was involved, but the pig was committed. And so you need to have people at the core who are really committed.
So you need some pigs out there, right?
That's right. Who really? And then you need outside that a whole lot of people who are the laying the eggs, so to speak, and they're supplying money and time and effort and do volunteer work. But that's what it takes. And I think there is a lot of communication among the key activists. I really do. I think it's at that stage. But the trick is they really need to get the owners in larger numbers to understand that they are involved in this and that these people are actually looking out for their interests. They're not just a bunch of crazy people with weird ideas who wear tinfoil hats. They've got, unless the owners begin to subscribe and there's a publication or something, you've got to create a group that they can subscribe to, that they can belong to, that they can send money to, where they get something out of it. They get a calendar of events, a newsletter, that sort of thing. That's what they need. They need something to link them that induces people to join. You need to provide a selective benefit to people to join so you can get owners to fund and capitalize the org. The only other way, other than that, is a foundation grant or some kind of a benefactor. But you've got to get it off the ground, you know, and create a presence. And that's the stage people are at right now. They need to do that. Maybe, you know, if there are more fiscal problems with associations, that will form be a kind of a catalyzing event.
I don't know, but if anybody out there is listening who's good at organizing, I'm not. I'm good at doing what I do, so I'll continue doing that. I'm not much of a group person. I'm not good at bringing everybody together. Pulling everyone together.
You know, out in California, remember Robin Boyer Stewart? She tried to do that in California. Remember that?
I think Robin was a little before. I mean, I've heard the name, but she
I wrote about it in the last chapter of my book on this. I documented what she was doing because I was very intrigued about whether it would work. Could she get the owners organized? And she concluded no, that it's impossible, that they simply won't. She just gave up.
Well, we had the Council for Homeowner Rights that I was involved with here in Virginia, Maryland, and D.C. And that started off great but kind of fell apart because, again, the homeowners wanted different things. A lot of the homeowners wanted their little problem fixed,
right.
And at the time their problem was a bad board member or a board member they didn't like. They refuse to see the big picture. And that's
right.
My concern. There are very few people who are willing to step back and take a look at the big picture. And if they can't get together in a smaller group and run their associations properly, I wonder if they can, how many of them are capable of just getting together in a big group across the country trying to effect change.
Yes. Well, I can tell you, if this is any indication, I get emails and phone calls and letters and everything all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, constantly from people.
Right.
And they're always the same.
Yep.
They always say that there's this particular problem involving what the board of directors is doing and is it legal or not or what can I do about it?
Yeah.
That's it. I haven't in years gotten one from somebody saying, I'm starting a group. How can I get it going? Now, everyone sees this as an individual problem about their individual director and their individual board and the maintenance contract for the landscaping, but the big picture, is they don't get it, and I don't know how you overcome that problem. That is why Robin Boyer Stewart gave up on it, I believe, and then when Jean Couturier was trying to do the same thing, he came to basically the same conclusion. He went all over the country interviewing and talking with people. And came to the same conclusion. This was going to be very, very difficult to do.
Because Jean Couturier wanted to involve CAI, he didn't believe that the homeowners on their own could do it. They needed permission from CAI, and they needed to work with CAI to maintain some of their rights. That's where he had a whole lot of problems.
Well, he believed, and I discussed this with him at some length, because he had relatives in Oak Park, and when I was living there, we would get together and talked about this several times when he was in town. He was very, very concerned that the owners were simply not going to support a national organization. That you could not overcome you couldn't get from the level of having small little groups run by dedicated individuals to a larger group that is supported by a substantial number of people across the country or across a region. And I think that's why he felt they had to work with the existing interest group or trade association framework simply because he couldn't figure out a way to transcend that. And he based that on traveling around talking to people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he did this before because he was a board member of MHA, and he and I had a lot of arguments about that as well. You know, you have to get permission from CAI. I said, no, you don't. It's your home. But, I mean, he lived in a condo and I didn't, so there may have been a different perception there as well.
Well, I don't know about permission. I understand the thing is, I think the issue is what he's talking about. Maybe you understand it differently than this, but was that there's no, if you either the association of owners has to be freestanding and fund itself, or they have to have somebody fund them and contribute to them and support them institutionally. Now, if the owners are not going to do this because they are impossible to organize because they're basically consumers, then if that is true, I'm not saying it is, but if it is true, then you have to turn elsewhere. You either turn to the trade associations or you turn to foundations to try to get a foundation grant. And when I tried to even get money to study this problem, various big foundations that I went to basically said, well, we don't care about this. This is a bunch of rich white suburbanites.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the question is, where's the money going to come from, really? A lot of it comes down to money. Where's the money going to come from?
It does. It is. I don't know. I think I would like to leave the existing groups intact because I think some of them are doing a really good job. And one of the nice things is that some of the groups, some of the states have held their own conferences, New Jersey, California, Florida, Texas. And that, I think, is a positive first step.
Oh, definitely. Look, some of these groups are excellent. I mean, Marjorie Murray's done a great job in California, and Jan Bergman in Florida, and you could go on and on. They're very good organizations. They really are. They're very effective.
Yeah,
in Arizona. But if you want to counter a national organization, you've got to create some kind of national organization yourself, I think.
Me, Shu? Or are you talking about the homeowners?
Not you.
Oh, okay.
I mean, hypothetically, you should. But no, I mean that is the only way it can really be done. And that's so far been the difficult part, and I hope that they, in the years to come, something happens to transcend the whatever has prevented that from happening.
Well, I'm kind of hoping to leave the existing groups intact because I think they're individually doing, I don't always agree with everything each one of them does, but I think that they are doing a good job.
Oh, yeah.
I
agree.
I'd just like to bring them under an umbrella organization.
Yeah, they have to be because the scale, if they're focused on their own state, and the problems are national and structural. You know, we've got to somehow move from the important work they're doing on the process regulation, which does need to be done, to the bigger issues. These big issues that are affecting every single person, and that's got to take place. And hopefully it will. We'll see.
Evan, we're out of time. I can't believe the hour's gone so fast.
It's always a pleasure.
Thank you so much for coming. This has been a totally different perspective on what we normally talk about. But I hope, we've really gone the really big picture this time with the meltdown. We haven't had the meltdown before, and we haven't had Freddie and Fannie sort of in the doldrums. And so sort of been watching the dominoes fall.
Yeah.
And the big ones are coming down.
Yeah, what would have happened if a year ago someone had predicted that Fannie Mae was going to collapse?
Didn't you have something on your web about a letter that John McCain had written about?
Yes.
And nobody paid attention to that.
Nobody paid the slightest. 2006, no one paid the slightest attention. He wrote a letter saying that he was concerned that Fannie Mae could collapse and jeopardize the entire economy. And everyone said, yeah, sure. Impossible.
Right. So there you go. But I hope you'll come back. You know, we'll follow this. I'll keep reading your web. You want to give us the address one more time?
It's privatopia.blogspot.com.
Check it out, folks. There's a lot of good stuff there. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Shu.
Thank you, Evan.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife.
It seemed that life was perfect. All my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs. Life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice for HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.